Zacharias.
Morning.
Morning.
Today, our Wednesday sitting opens our spring practice period, which will last until nearly the end of June, middle of June. So, today, I think it's very appropriate to have Bodhisattva ceremony, where we acknowledge our shortcomings, our ancient Tantric karma, and renew our vows of practice. That's what's going on there. We honor all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and renew our vows. So we start with a fresh beginning. And this afternoon we will install our head student, or Shuso, Andrea Thatch, Ryushin, Dragonheart. Good beginning. I know that this dragon has in her heart to take care of everyone compassionately, and it's a wonderful experience for her, and she's very excited about it. And I would like all of us to take care of her as well. The purpose of having a head student, Shuso, shares the seat of the abbot for this period. And the main task of the Shuso is to be an example. Just be a good example of how we practice, how we maintain precepts, how we act compassionately, how we are sensitive to everyone's position, and exercise humility, because it's a very wonderful position. Everybody's looking at you in some way. And so how you deal with that is very important. It's kind of like on stage thing, and how you actually act in a manner that is encouraging and inspiring and humble. So balancing these characteristics, also a very strong person, very strong-minded person, a doctor in this case, someone who's well-educated, intelligent, and well-experienced in many ways. In Japanese monastery, the Shuso is usually 20, 21. In our practice, they're older. Somewhat older. And experience is much greater, much deeper. So, at the end of the practice period, we have a Shuso ceremony in which the Shuso sits in that seat and asks everyone to offer a question. So, the people in the practice period who have signed up for the practice period will ask the questions. And I would like to invite all of you who are in the practice period to save that day for that event. Not do something else on that day. So this is a kind of testing of the Shuso's understanding. Not just understanding, but how you relate to each other. So during the practice period, the Shuso will be having teas, and you can sign up for the teas, and you can discuss the Dharma with the Shuso in a kind of relaxed way. So, one of the main things about practice period is, you know, because this is a not a monastery, and we all live at home and have our own individual lives. Every one of us who is attends the practice period creates their own schedule given the responsibilities and the time that you can actually give to that. So we ask everybody to make a sheet, a form that says what you're going to do. But that promise is for you, mainly, for you to honor your own commitment. If you don't honor your own commitment, it's not, it does affect everyone, because we're all practicing in a certain way together, even though we all each have a different schedule. But it works if we all keep our commitments to ourselves. That's the most important thing. So you should be careful when you make your commitment to not overextend yourself, or just pick and choose. Those are the two extremes. Well, I think I'll do this, and I think I'll do that. No, you should want to, I would say, should want to do the whole thing completely, but then you subtract all the reasons why you can't, and then you're left with what you can do. But if you just kind of pick and choose what you like, it's not quite committed. So, anyway, so in practice period, we all add our strengths and our intentions to doing this thing together. And even just extending yourself a little bit more than you do ordinarily, for most people, makes the practice period gives it an edge. So be careful. If you overextend yourself and then you feel you can't do what you intended, then you feel discouraged. So you have to be very careful. So this is like a practice period. Is the reason why we have it in the spring for me is because it sets the tone for the rest of our practice for the year, how we practice the rest of the year. We used to have it in the fall, but then it's a little different. This kind of helps you to adjust yourself to practice for the rest of the year and sets a good tone for doing that. So every once in a while we have to gather ourselves together and renew our practice. So this is what the Bodhisattvas do. Every month we come together and renew our practice. And for a practice period, once a year we come together. We also have aspects of practice in the fall, which is a kind of practice period as well. But this spring practice period brings us together to renew our practice together and sets the tone for the rest of the year. So, I have a koan. I have a koan to set the tone for our practice period. And this is from the Muman Khan, Master Muman's collection of koans. And the principal monk here is Lutzu, who was a great grandson of Master Muman, or actually a great grandfather, Dharma grandfather of Master Muman. And the koan goes like this. Lutzu said, Shakyamuni and Maitreya are servants of that one. Tell me, who is that one? That's the koan. And then Master Muman has a comment, and he says, if you can see this one and distinguish this one, of this him or her, clearly, then it is like encountering your grandfather at the crossroads. You will not need to ask somebody else whether or not you are correct or right. And then Master Muman has a verse. Don't draw another's bow. Don't ride another's horse. Don't discuss another's faults. Don't explore another's affairs. So this is kind of like in two parts, this koan. So Master Wutsu says, Shakyamuni and Maitreya are servants of that one. There's a character that means both this one and the other. Another. So sometimes it's used to mean another, and sometimes it's used to mean this one. And it's used in both senses in this koan. Sometimes the translator will use this another all the way through. But I think it's better, this one and another, because this one is non-dualistic. And another is dualistic. So these are the two sides of our practice, duality and non-duality. Shakyamuni and Maitreya are servants of that one, or this, or one. You can say it in many ways. There was a time in the early part of I don't know what century, but sometime after the first century, where the Mahayana needed to create three bodies of Buddha in order to differentiate the various aspects of who is Buddha. I've talked about this a lot, but it's very important to understand the three bodies of yourself. So, who is that one? Who is Shakyamuni and Maitreya? Servants of, you know, we think, well, Shakyamuni, if you're a Buddhist, you think, well, Shakyamuni is the highest Buddha, right? Well, not exactly. Shakyamuni is a Nirmanakaya Buddha who, but he's also an attribute of Dharmakaya Buddha. And his expounding is Sambhogakaya Buddha. These are his three bodies, which are also your three bodies. So, who is Shakyamuni? Who is Maitreya? Shakyamuni is like the Buddha of the past. Maitreya is the Buddha of the future. We, you know, in the old days, they said Maitreya Buddha was sitting there in Tushita heaven, and after some number of kalpas, he will descend and become the next Buddha of the next aeon. Whereas Shakyamuni is the Buddha of the last aeon. But who is the present? Who is the Buddha of the present? So, you know, in the old meal chant, our original meal chant, which is close to the original, it says, homage to all Shakyamuni Buddhas all over the world. So, when we talk about Shakyamuni Buddha, we think of the Buddha of the past. But actually, when one has realization, they are Shakyamuni Buddha. So there are many, many Shakyamuni Buddhas all over the world. As a matter of fact, all Bodhisattvas are Shakyamuni Buddhas. So this is extending this kind of understanding that there's not just one Buddha. This is Mahayana understanding. So who is Maitreya? The Buddha of the future. Somebody, is there such a thing as Tushita heaven? I mean, come on. Tushita heaven is here. Heaven and hell are in our own minds. Matter of fact, the whole thing is in our own mind. But it's meaningful. You say, oh, just in our own mind. Well, what is our mind? Our big mind is Dharmakaya Buddha. This is the source of mind. We call it Dharmakaya, the Dharma realm, which we also call it Buddha nature. We call it big mind. We call it divine light. Usually you don't hear that so much. Radiant light. But actually, when you study Buddhism or Zen, it's all throughout the literature. Dharmakaya is divine light. Your true nature is divine light. Sometimes it's called radiant. Sometimes it's called divine. Sometimes it's called brightness. Brightness is kind of like an attribute. Radiance is like a projection. Divine is like, the actual meaning of divine is like a deity, from a deity, which causes this little problem in Buddhism, because there is no deity in Buddhism. And yet, Buddhism leaves it undefined, non-defined. When Buddha was asked, when Shakyamuni was asked, is there a deity or no, or not a deity, and he says, he didn't answer. He didn't say yes, and he didn't say no. This is one of those questions that he would not say yes or no to. So, Buddhism, Mahayana Buddhism, leans toward deification, even though Buddhism will not admit of a deity. Esoteric Buddhism has many deities. Tibetan Buddhism, Shingon in Japan, has many demigods. And I don't consider them gods. They're spiritual. They're aspects of our own spiritual being. So it's not like it's something up in the sky, somebody in the sky. It's like our own innate the right word, you know. I don't want to misuse the words. But divinity, you might say, even though that's not an appropriate word, but it comes as closest. These are all expressions of Dharmakaya. So it's fine to say Dharmakaya because there's no connotation to Dharmakaya, because it cannot be defined. It's non-definable. But light is a kind of, gives us something to tangibility. And if you look at the Buddha on the altar, he has a halo. So that's light. And he also has a little glass bead in his forehead, which is kind of beam. So this is all throughout Buddhism. Luminosity is another word for enlightenment. So enlightenment comes from luminosity. So we're always concerned in Zen, and especially about enlightenment is the big deal in Zen, right? So it's luminosity. How is it expressed as luminosity? So don't hinder it. This is, you know, the main practice in Zen is don't hinder it. Don't cover it up. So, Wu Tzu said, Shakyamuni and Maitreya are servants of that one. Tell me, who is that one? Well, you have to show who is that one. So it all comes down to, who are you? Where is your essence? Where do you find your essence? So then, Master Wu Man says, if you can see this one and distinguish him or her clearly, then it is like encountering your, this is translated in various ways, your father at the crossroads. It's also translated as seeing your grandfather in the town. You will not need to ask somebody whether or not you're right. You know. But you just know. Which doesn't mean you shouldn't check it out, even if you know. Dogen's prime Dharma successor was Ajo. And Ajo wrote one essay, I guess you'd call it, called Komyo-zo Zamai. Komyo means radiant light, or bright light, or divine light, depending on how you want to translate it. And there's a little excerpt from Komyo that says the same thing. He talks about Komyo means light, so he's talking about the various aspects of light, which is, of course, the expression of Zazen and the expression of all of our dharmic activities. So he says, I have to find a place to start here because I'm breaking into his thinking. So he says, when you are born, the light is not born. When you die, the light does not die. It does not increase in Buddhas. It does not decrease in sentient beings. Neither is it diluted, even if you are. Not enlightened, even if you are. It has no special position or appearance or name. This is the whole body of all phenomena. You can't grasp it and you can't throw it away. It is unattainable, although it is unattainable, it penetrates the whole body. The whole body means the whole universe. From the highest heaven down to the lowest hell, all places are perfectly illumined in this way. This is the divine, inconceivable spiritual light. If you trustfully open yourself to and believe the profound meaning of these words, you will not need to ask someone else what is true or false. You will be as intimate with the reality as if you were to come face to face with your grandfather in a town. They're the same. But I think that Ajo got it from this koan, because he does talk about this koan in his Komyo-zo, which we will be studying in our class. So then, I want to go back a little bit to Maitreya. You know, when will the... in Judaism, they have the same thing, you know, the Messiah, right? Waiting for some great being to come and save us, right? Well, the great being that comes to save us has to be ourself. Each one of us is Maitreya Buddha. Maitreya Buddha lies somewhere inside of each one of us. And little by little, Maitreya comes out. When you're enlightened, Maitreya is there. We don't have to worry about the future. So, in Luhmann's verse, he says, don't draw another's bow, don't ride another's horse, don't discuss another's faults, don't explore another's affairs. So he's giving us practice instructions. He's saying, this is how you, this is fundamental practice. And if you practice this way, you won't obscure your nature. So don't draw another's bow, means draw your own bow. Drawing another's bow means doing another's work for them, or doing something that's not your own. In other words, stealing something else, stealing somebody's virtue. You can't do that. You have to find your own. This is the base of the practice. Drawing your own bow means do your own practice. Don't ride another's horse. Well, find your own way of conducting yourself. Find your own... These two go together. Don't draw another's bow. Don't ride another's horse. You have to find it yourself. Don't discuss another's faults. Has to do with... It's a precept, right? Don't discuss the faults of others. This patriarch has a very long poem about don't discuss the faults of others. Don't, no fault finding. This is a practice that I want all of us to pay attention to during this practice period. No fault finding. As soon as you see yourself fault finding, you know, it goes on in your head. You may not say something, but if you think about how what the conversation in your head is when somebody does something you don't like, or when you see something off, or some the stuff is going on in your head, all, you know, criticism, right? How do you avoid that? How do you turn criticism into something constructive? How do you transform criticism into something that's constructive or that's supportive? How do you do that? Just simply to dwell on criticism or fault-finding is poison. So how do you turn poison into nectar? And don't explore another's affairs. In other words, no gossip. You may see people and you may want to talk to your neighbor about so-and-so. No gossip. We see how everybody is. How do we turn that desire to talk about somebody into something positive or supportive? Or trying to understand, how do you turn that something that is poisonous, like gossip, into something positive? Like trying to understand how people do things and why they do them, and not be so quick to share the criticism with others, but to look at your own faults, look at your own shortcomings, and deal with those, and be able to ask for help. But it's good to be able to figure something out for yourself. You know, if you see your own shortcoming, then how do you work on that? Because when we're ready to criticize somebody, it usually has something to do with our own shortcomings. So how do we express compassion instead of criticism? How do we express compassion instead of idle talk? This is promoting the practice. This is how we illuminate the practice. As soon as we stop doing these kinds of, destructive practices, the practice becomes illuminated. Sometimes we get very angry at people. And it's normal to get angry. You should get angry when somebody doesn't. You should get angry. But if you carry that around with you, then it's poison. How do you allow yourself to get angry and then turn that into something positive? How can you allow your anger to transform into compassion? I don't mean feeling sorry. Compassion means I'm trying to understand how things happen and why they happen. Then you're on top of it instead of underneath it. So how do you stay on top? No matter how angry you are with somebody, the other side is compassion. Otherwise, you lose your friend. I'll never see that person again. You're just cutting off your nose despite your anger. How do you stay on top of things without being inundated or victimized by your own emotions? So there's another part of this, stopping there, which is, I wrote down, where does our authority come from? Where does our authority come from? Where does Buddha's authority come from? Where does Shakyamuni's authority come from? So, well, he has his own authority. Well, what does that mean? The personal authority? Divine authority? What kind of authority? I mean, this is why religion, you know, originally originated. Because there has to be some authority more than you. There has to be an authority above you. This is 12-step program. There has to be an authority above you, otherwise you become the authority. And then you can do whatever you want. You can start a war. You can persecute people. You can do whatever you want. If you don't know that there's an authority over you, which you are subject to. So that's a big question mark. And a very good koan. That's this koan. Shakyamuni and Maitreya are servants of that one. Tell me, who is that one?